12 p.m. on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. Coming up next is Democracy Now! Views expressed in this syndicated program are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect the views or positions of CFRC 101.9 FM, Radio Queen's University.
I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! This is CFRC 101.9 FM, www.cfrc.ca, Queen's University, Kingston, Ontario.
You're listening to CFRC 101.9 FM, broadcasting from Cataraqui on Anishinaabe and Haudenosaunee land.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
I think it's safe to say this is a genocide. And now we're in the situation where we're seeing starvation and we're seeing the denial of humanitarian aid and the destruction of the food system itself in Gaza.
At the United Nations, Israel's facing accusations it's carrying out a starvation campaign in Gaza. We'll speak with two UN special rapporteurs, then Yale professor Jason Stanley, author of the new book, Erasing History, How Fascists Rewrite the Past to Control the Future.
In my book, Erasing History, I talk about the attack on public education and progressive education. Trump and Vance threatened this because they promised patriotic education, replacing Black history and the perspective of LGBTQ Americans with the exploits of great white Christian men.
And as Donald Trump continues to dehumanize immigrants and promise mass deportations if elected president, starting in Springfield, Ohio, we'll speak with an immigrant activist in El Paso, Texas, and with Pamela Yates, director of the new film Borderland, The Line Within, about the profitable business of criminalizing immigration and its human cost.
What if we knew the infrastructure that Hitler was building before World War II? What would we do with that knowledge?
So that you go from your house to your Dunkin' Donuts and you pass a detention facility and you don't even know that it exists.
The infrastructure that was being prepared.
That was the end game.
Getting prepared for massive separations, massive deportations.
Right. I mean, that was the end game. We kept saying that's the end game.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu says he's expanded his goals for the war on Gaza to include the return of Israelis displaced by fighting near the border with Lebanon. Netanyahu's office announced the escalation after an overnight meeting of Israel's security cabinet and just hours after Israel's war chief, Yoav Gallant, told a senior advisor to President Biden, quote, the only way left to return the residents of the north to their homes is via military action, unquote. U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin responded by warning Gallant a full-scale war with Hezbollah would lead to devastating consequences. The Palestinian Education Ministry reports Israeli attacks have killed more than 11,000 students across the Gaza Strip and occupied West Bank since last October 7th. In one of the latest assaults, at least 20 Palestinians were killed when Israel's military bombed the El Bereij refugee camp in central Gaza. Five others were killed in an attack on Gaza City's Al Zaytun neighborhood. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken is visiting Egypt today to discuss a potential Gaza ceasefire and the release of hostages. Blinken's visit comes as top experts at the U.N. have strongly condemned the United States and other Western nations for supporting Israel's devastating assault on Gaza. Francesca Albanese, the U.N. Special Rapporteur on the occupied Palestinian territory, spoke Monday.
I think that it's unavoidable for Israel to become a pariah in the face of its continuous, relentless, vilifying assault on the United Nations on top of millions of Palestinians.
In campaign news, Donald Trump and his running mate J.D. Vance have seized on Sunday's apparent assassination attempt on Trump to accuse their Democratic rivals for their rhetoric, they said. This is Vance at a Faith and Freedom Coalition event in Atlanta Monday.
No one has tried to kill Kamala Harris in the last couple of months, and two people now have tried to kill Donald Trump in the last couple of months. I'd say that's pretty strong evidence that the left needs to tone down the rhetoric and needs to cut this crap out. Somebody's going to get hurt by it.
Trump ally Elon Musk amplified the Trump campaign message, tweeting then deleting a response to an ex-user in which the billionaire ex-owner Elon Musk mused, and no one is even trying to assassinate Biden Kamala, along with a thinking face emoji. The Secret Service said afterwards it's aware of the post and reiterated it investigates all such threats. Meanwhile, Democratic lawmaker Jamie Raskin, who led the House Select Committee investigating the January 6th Capitol insurrection, told The Washington Post Kamala Harris and Tim Walz, quote, do not talk about bloodbaths, American carnage, overturning the rule of law or the Constitution, or imprisoning and exacting revenge against their opponents, said Raskin. He added, quote, only one candidate in this race has been impeached in a bipartisan vote for inciting a violent insurrection against our government, unquote. On Monday, 58-year-old Ryan Ralph, the suspect in Sunday's apparent assassination attempt at Donald Trump's Florida golf course, appeared in federal court. Prosecutors say Ralph spent nearly 12 hours lying in wait with a rifle for Trump before a Secret Service agent fired on him, scuttling his plans to shoot at Trump. This is U.S. Attorney for the Southern District of Florida, Markenzie LaPointe.
Ralph was charged federally with possession of a firearm by a convicted felon, and possession and receipt of a firearm with an obliterated serial number.
Markenzie LaPointe is the first Haitian American to serve as U.S. attorney. In Ohio, Republican Governor Mike DeWine announced he's deploying state troopers and conducting daily bomb sweeps in Springfield schools after racist and inflammatory comments by Trump, Vance and other Republican officials against Springfield's Haitian community led to 33 separate bomb threats. During a recent CNN interview about the lies he's helping spread about the Haitian community, J.D. Vance said he's willing to, quote, create stories. The city of Springfield also announced it's canceling its annual Culture Fest that was scheduled for later this month. Russian President Vladimir Putin has ordered his military to expand the number of active duty troops by 180,000 to a total of 1.5 million. It's the third increase in troop size since Russia invaded Ukraine in early 2022. With the decree, it's likely Putin will have to either expand the draft or change Russian law to allow more women into the military. This comes just days after Putin warned the U.S. and its NATO allies against allowing Ukraine to use Western arms to strike deeper inside Russia.
If this decision is made, it will mean nothing less than the direct participation of NATO countries, the United States, and European countries in the war in Ukraine. This is their direct participation, and this, of course, significantly changes the very essence, the very nature of the conflict.
On Friday, President Biden shrugged off Putin's threat, telling reporters, quote, I don't think much about Vladimir Putin. Afghanistan's Taliban has suspended a UN-led polio eradication effort, ordering a halt to house-to-house vaccinations. It's a major setback to the global polio eradication initiative. So far this year, the World Health Organization's identified 18 polio cases in Afghanistan, triple the number recorded all of last year. In Massachusetts, a man set himself on fire last Wednesday near the Israeli consulate in Boston to protest the war on Gaza. He was reportedly hospitalized immediately after with severe burns, but few other details are known. Matt Nelson's believed to be the third person to self-immolate outside an Israeli consulate over the past 11 months. Video has circulated online purportedly of Nelson speaking ahead of his self-immolation.
My name is Matt Nelson, and I'm about to engage in an extreme act of protest. We are all culpable in the ongoing genocide in Gaza. We call ourselves the greatest nation in history, yet we spend more on weapons of war than we do on educating our children, helping the homeless, ensuring all Americans have equal rights, and protecting the environment combined. We are slaves to capitalism and the military-industrial complex. Most of us are too apathetic to care. The protests I'm about to engage in is a call to our government to stop supplying Israel with the money and weapons it uses to imprison and murder innocent Palestinians, to pressure Israel to end the genocide in Gaza, and to support the ICC indictment of Benjamin Netanyahu and other members of the Israeli government.
Meanwhile, in Newton, Massachusetts, a U.S. veteran was charged with assaulting and shooting a man who was defending Palestinian rights to a group of pro-Israel protesters. Here in New York, the NYPD is facing public outrage after an officer shot four people following a suspected subway fare evasion. The police officer ended up sending the suspect, two bystanders, and another police officer to the hospital. The NYCLU said, quote, "This deeply disturbing incident shows why endlessly relying on more police and subways and harsh crackdowns for minor offenses won't bring true community safety," they said. And in Georgia, protesters interrupted Atlanta City Council meeting Monday to demand a public referendum on the massive 85-acre police training complex known as Cop City. Monday's protest came 1 year after the Vote to Stop Cop City coalition in Atlanta submitted more than 116,000 signatures calling for a ballot measure on the fate of Cop City, whose estimated budget has ballooned to $110 million. Atlanta officials led by Mayor Andre Dickens have so far committed $67 million in public funds to the project while racking up outside legal fees in a bid to keep a referendum off the November ballot. On Monday, protesters released thousands of ping pong balls into the Atlanta City Council chambers and unfurled a banner reading, "Andre Dickens, you dropped the ball on democracy." This is Pastor Kiana Jones Moore speaking during a public comment ahead of the protest.
If you're so confident in what you have to offer, then give people a choice. Andre Dickens constantly says that this project has overwhelming support. Well, all right then, Andre, why are you working so hard to keep people from voting? Because 116,000 people, whether they want Cop City or not, believe that people should be able to vote on the issue.
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The Warrant Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Top experts at the United Nations have strongly condemned Western countries for supporting Israel's devastating war on Gaza. Speakers at a UN press conference Monday included Pedro Arroyo Agudo, the UN Special Rapporteur on the human rights to safe drinking water and sanitation.
The lack of clean water has led to 1.7 million cases of infection diseases, mainly diarrhea, dysentery, and hepatitis A, particularly affecting children, as well as cases of polio, smallpox, and other infectious diseases that can trigger massive and deadly epidemics. All this coupled with the lack of medical care result in deaths, especially of babies and children, making water scarcity and contamination a silent bomb, which has far less visibility than those that destroy buildings, but are no less lethal bomb.
This comes as the UN Special Rapporteur on the Right to Food, Michael Fakhry, has accused Israel in a new report of carrying out a starvation campaign in Gaza. Francesca Albanese, the UN Special Rapporteur on the Occupied Palestinian Territory, wrote in response to the report, quote, "The way Israel is destroying Palestinian food sovereignty will be studied not only as a shocking example of genocidal conduct, but also as a textbook case of sadistic disrespect. Respect for human life and dignity," unquote. UN Special Rapporteur's Francesca Albanese is joining us now from Tunisia, and Michael Fakhry is joining us from Brasilia in Brazil. We thank you both for being with us. Michael Fakhry, let's begin with you. You have just released this report. Can you explain what you found?
Yes, Amy. What we're witnessing in Gaza is the starvation of 2.3 million Palestinians. We've never seen a civilian population made to go hungry so quickly and so completely. So in this report, I answer the question, how was this possible? How was Israel able to starve so many Palestinians so quickly and so completely? And the story starts, of course, with the political economy of Gaza. This story starts to, in some ways, in 1991. Israel started restricting the flow of goods into Gaza starting in 1991. By 2000, it imposes a full blockade. So what we saw from 2000 to 2002 is the rate of malnutrition amongst children in Gaza double. In 2005, what Israel did is it changed the nature of its occupation. It pulled its military out of Gaza and surrounded Gaza in a siege. So since 2000 until now, Israel has created a wall, in effect, a wall around Gaza, limiting the flow of goods. And what they did is they counted calories. They made sure that people in Gaza were just hungry enough to be weak, but not so hungry to raise an alarm. So right before October 7th of last year, 50% of Palestinians in Gaza were food insecure, and 80% depended on humanitarian aid. So when this war started, Israel announced its starvation campaign on October 9th. And that's in effect what they did. And they've been pushing people from the north into the south, while at the same time continuing to bomb civilian structures and target schools, hospitals, and homes.
Can you explain, this is the first report that includes graphic reporting, Michael Fakhry.
Yes, the situation is so horrific in Gaza right now that I felt that words weren't enough to explain what's going on, but words weren't enough also to imagine a better future for Palestinians, but for people all over the world. This report focuses on the Palestinian people's food sovereignty, but it looks at how starvation is being used as an increasing rate by forces all over the world. And so I was lucky to work with Omar Khoury, an artist from Lebanon. And what we presented are illustrations and graphic reports highlighting the struggle of fishers, highlighting what food sovereignty means for the Palestinian people, but for everyone, and highlighting what it means to maintain and fight for your dignity despite the genocidal violence that the Palestinians are experiencing.
Michael Fakhry, who did you talk to for this report?
For this report, I've consulted starvation and right to food experts from all over the world. I received direct testimony from people in Gaza. I spoke to UN workers, both within Palestinian territories and around the world. I spoke to diplomats from countries from all over the world. And I did my own research, and I drew from statistics from the UN. And this was standard methodology for any UN human rights report.
So Israel's finance minister, Bezalel Smotrich, has suggested starving the entire Gaza Strip to death could be justified. He told a conference last month, quote, "Nobody will let us cause 2 million civilians to die of hunger, even though it might be justified and moral, until our hostages are returned." Smotrich also repeated the Israeli government's goal of removing the threat of Palestinian state. You have that, and then you also have what Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said, that accusations of Israel limiting humanitarian aid were outrageously false. He said a deliberate starvation policy, you can say anything, it doesn't make it true. Your response, UN Rapporteur Michael Fakhry.
There is never an exception to starving civilians. There is never a justification for starving any civilian, whether it's one person or 2.3 million. And this is in the context of genocide. And there is no exception to genocide. Israeli officials, since October 9th until today, have explicitly announced their intent to starve civilians. And they've executed their plan, and we've seen the effects of their plan. We also have received reports regularly and consistently from UN sources that humanitarian aid is either blocked or restricted. And then even when it goes through, these humanitarian convoys that are coordinating with Israeli forces are targeted by Israeli forces. And then even when these humanitarian aid convoys reach civilians have been repeatedly targeted, shot, and killed while trying trying to get aid. But the issue is not just aid and the denial of goods. The issue is Israel has been weakening and destroying the food system in Gaza in this war and previously. Over 75% of the agricultural system has been destroyed. Fishers have been targeted. Orchards have been uprooted. Shepherds have been targeted and shot at. So what Israel is trying to do is they're trying to make sure that the Palestinian people can't feed themselves. This starvation campaign is part of displacing Palestinians from their land, and it's part of a plan to annex not just Gaza, but the West Bank as well. This is the last 2 years we've seen record violence against Palestinians, especially Palestinian farmers. This is, again, targeting all Palestinians in all of their territories. So it's not just about Gaza. It's Israel has, over the decades, attacked and destroyed the Palestinian food system as a way to create the conditions of starvation, and in this case now to the degree of genocidal violence.
Michael Fakhry, according to your report, 34 Palestinians, the majority of them children, are known to have starved to death since October 7th?
Yes, and this is what indicates to us that it's a full-blown famine across all of Gaza. So you can imagine a situation when a community is struggling, the first thing they always do is they feed their children. This is true throughout history. And so when a parent is watching their child waste away before their very eyes and is unable to do anything, and that child dies, when the first child dies in a community, that indicates to us that that whole society is being attacked. And when the first Palestinian child died, that confirmed that the situation in Gaza is a situation of famine.
Now, you're expecting to present this report to the UN General Assembly in October. What are you expecting? How will this be presented?
Right now, all of us, all the UN human rights experts, and I think the whole world is watching closely the current draft resolution that's before the General Assembly. That is, in the draft, they're calling for sanctions against Israel. Since the first weeks of this war, we as independent human rights experts have been calling for a ceasefire, an immediate ceasefire, and sanctions against Israel. And we'll see how this resolution goes through. By the time I get to New York on October 18th, if there are no sanctions, I will repeat that call for sanctions against Israel. And what I will tell the General Assembly, what is at stake? What is at stake is the global order itself. How the world responds to Gaza and to the Palestinian struggle for liberation will determine the structure and the fate of the UN and the global order. Because what's at stake is, of course, the Palestinian people's right to self-determination, their right to return to their territory in Palestine, and American global power, and and Europe is facing an existential crisis. This is what's at stake. This is why millions of people are marching in the streets in solidarity with the Palestinians. If the world does not respond to Palestine today, just like the world is not responding to the starvation in Sudan, we are going to see more and more starvation campaigns around the world into the future.
We want to bring in Francesca Albanese into this conversation, UN Special Rapporteur on the Occupied Palestinian Territory. You're in La Marsa, Tunisia, where you participated in that news conference yesterday in Geneva. Talked about the significance of this report. Can you respond?
Yes, I was really impressed by the report that my colleague Michael Fakhry produced, because not only it analyzed what he just said, I cannot really add to the brilliant presentation he gave, but it put things in context, which is something that tends to be missed when discussing the situation of Palestinians under Israeli military rule. People tend to align themselves or accept acritically the narrative of the two parties in conflict without capturing the troubling asymmetry that exists between the Palestinians, the occupied people, and Israel, the protracted occupier, which is colonizing, annexing by force the little territory that remains. So the fact of bringing the attention back to the root causes and the fact that these didn't start on October 7th, didn't start even with the blockade that has been declared on Gaza 17 years ago. This is a long-term plan that Israel has somewhat devised to achieve its final goal, which is getting as much control as possible over maximum land with minimum Palestinian people.
Nazi, you've said the attack that Israel has unleashed is not just against Palestinians in Gaza, it's against Palestinians as a whole. Explain.
Absolutely. Amy, since the beginning of the assault against Gaza on the beginning of October, following, of course, the attack unleashed by Hamas and other Palestinian armed groups, we have recorded an escalation of violence against the Palestinians in the rest of the occupied territory, both in Jerusalem and the West Bank. Over 11 months, 670 Palestinians have been killed. Curfew, incursions and raids have escalated at unprecedented rates, particularly against the North and Gaza, that over the past 2 weeks has experienced less lethal but similar attacks on civilian infrastructure, roads, water reservoir, electricity sources and homes that are unjustifiable. And the other thing is the detention, arbitrary detention, detention without any legal justification of Palestinians, both from the West, the Gaza Strip, but all the more, the West Bank and East Jerusalem have skyrocketed. And all Palestinians, no matter their place of residence, have been exposed to humiliation and sadism and what B'Tselem has qualified as a network of torture across Israeli detention center. How can we explain that? This is why I say, when the international community has failed to prevent genocide in Gaza, we have to be very careful, because I do see patterns of violence clearly expanding to the West Bank and East Jerusalem. And ultimately, the goal is the same. Expel the Palestinians, forcibly displace the Palestinians from the little that remain of their land. And this is not something that I'm inferring from the evidence. This is something that is accompanied by endless statements of Israeli political leaders and actions of both army and settlers, illegal settlers that have been armed by Israeli ministers. So this is a state, there is a state endeavor sustaining this wild attack against the Palestinian people as such.
Francesca Albanese, we want to thank you for being with us, UN Special Rapporteur on the Occupied Palestinian Territory, speaking to us from La Marsa, Tunisia, and Michael Fakhry, UN Special Rapporteur on the Right to Food. We will link to your report. Well, you're going to present it at the United Nations next month. The report titled Starvation and the Right to Food, with an emphasis on the Palestinian people's food sovereignty. Michael Fakhry is a professor of law at the University of Oregon, where he leads the Food Resiliency Project, speaking to us from Brasilia, Brazil. Next up, Yale professor Jason Stanley on his new book, Erasing History: How Fascists Rewrite the Past to Control the Future. Stay with us.
والأرض لكم وأنتم الطريق.
Ard Lakum, The Land Is Yours by Feroz. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Election Day is now 7 weeks away. On Monday, Republican vice presidential nominee J.D. Vance lashed out at Democrats, saying liberal rhetoric is to blame for Sunday's apparent assassination attempt on Donald Trump at his golf course in Florida. Vance made no mention that the man arrested was actually a former Trump supporter. Vance spoke on Monday at a Faith and Freedom Coalition event in Atlanta.
But you know, the big difference between conservatives and liberals is that no one has tried to kill Kamala Harris in the last couple of months. And two people now have tried to kill Donald Trump in the last couple of months. I'd say that's pretty strong evidence that the left needs to tone down the rhetoric and needs to cut this crap out.
Monday, Trump ally Elon Musk posted a message on social media platform, his social media platform, X, that read, "And no one's even trying to assassinate Biden Kamala," along with a thinking face emoji. Musk deleted the message after widespread criticism. He's now being investigated by the Secret Service. J.D. Vance's remarks for Democrats to tone down their rhetoric came just days after Donald Trump repeatedly used inflammatory language to attack Vice President Kamala Harris during last week's ABC News presidential debate.
She's destroying this country, and if she becomes president, this country doesn't have a chance of success. Not only success, we'll end up being Venezuela on steroids, because they're destroying the fabric of our country by what they've done. There's never been anything done like this at all. They've destroyed the fabric of our country.
We're joined right now by Jason Stanley, author and professor of philosophy at Yale University. His new book titled Erasing History: How Fascists Rewrite the Past to Control the Future. Professor Stanley is the son of Holocaust survivors. This is your second book on fascism. Why are you writing it now, and the significance of its publication as this election, to say the least, heats up in its last weeks?
Well, I faced a puzzle when writing this book. Why is it that authoritarians always target schools and universities? So we see that all over the world. We see that with Viktor Orban, who provides a kind of template for U.S. authoritarianism. He attacked Central European University for gender ideology and leftism and being pro-immigration. And so we know about the courts, the authoritarians targeting the courts. But why do authoritarians always target voting? That's clear. And schools and universities. So when last year, when the anti-genocide, anti-war protests on campus were happening, I thought about the international context. I thought about what happened in India in 2019 when they passed the Citizenship Amendment Act, which made Muslims into second-class citizens. And there were nonviolent protests on campus denounced as anti-Indian. So violent militarized responses. So this tactic of tarring school teachers, tarring university professors as Marxists and communists and ruining the country, and replacing this kind of education, replacing Black history, replacing LGBTQ perspectives by a kind of grandiosity of white Christian nationalism, as we're seeing right now, this seemed to me a democratic emergency.
This is Republican vice presidential nominee J.D. Vance speaking in 2021 at the National Conservatism Conference. At the time, he was a candidate for the U.S. Senate in Ohio.
I think in this movement of national conservatism, what we need more than inspiration is we need wisdom. And there was a wisdom in what Richard Nixon said approximately 40, 50 years ago. He said, and I quote, "The professors are the enemy."
So that was J.D. Vance. The professors are the enemy. I also want to quote First Things magazine, a right-wing magazine. It says, universities should be places of sober analysis, but at Yale, philosophy professor Jason Stanley and history professor Timothy Snyder published books of political propaganda that describe Trump as the second coming of Adolf Hitler. TV newscasters intone rants rather than report on events. And of course, J.D. Vance, your fellow Yale colleague.
Yeah. So that's a strangeness about this moment, that all these people, the leaders of the movement to attack universities and schools, are all Ivy League grads. Ron DeSantis is a Yale and Harvard grad. Ted Cruz is a Princeton and Harvard grad. J.D. Vance is a Yale Law School grad. Tom Cotton is Harvard. Elise Stefanik is Harvard. So what's going on? That's a mystery. These guys are sending their kids to Harvard, Yale, and Princeton. They're not sending their kids to Hillsdale College. It's Hillsdale College for the rest of us, and Harvard, Yale, and Princeton for their kids. So they're attacking the institutions, the universities, because the universities provide critical inquiry into the kind of myths that's required for these kinds of politics. This kind of politics elevates the dominant group, in the case of the United States, white Christian men. It diminishes women, the agency of women, by represents history as the exploits in the United States of white Christian men. Like in India, history is represented as the exploits of Hindus. In Israel, it's represented as the exploits of Jewish nationalists who founded the state. This kind of erasure of history doesn't just justify wars and genocide. If you look at Russia, a case I look at extensively in the book, as well as Israel, in Russia, the erasure of Ukraine as an independent place, the complete erasure of Ukrainian history justifies Vladimir Putin's war on Ukraine, because it says it is sort of a fake identity, a fake country. It represents all Russian incursions as justified by supporting independence movements. Israel has erased the existence of the Palestinian people. It has erased the history, making the desert Jews made the desert bloom. This kind of thing erases Palestinians from the narrative of the country and of the area, and paves the way for genocide. This kind of erasing history paves the way for ethnic, racial, and religious nationalism, which is the core of the message we're hearing from MAGA Republicans today. When you erase black history, when you erase LGBTQ perspectives, when you erase social history of social movements, then you represent history as just the exploits of great white men. You erase social movements. You make citizens feel like they have no agency. And so it's an anti-democratic education. And then you justify great replacement theory, which is their core message, that the greatness of America comes from the exploits of great white men. And so we need to protect that identity.
Jason Stanley, you write in your book, Erasing History, the most visible current manifestation of the Black American tradition of reclaiming history is Nicole Hannah Jones' 1619 Project. She's, of course, the Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter for the New York Times Magazine, creator of the landmark 1619 Project, which reframes U.S. history by marking the year 1619, when the first enslaved Africans arrived on Virginia soil, as the country's foundational date. This is then-President Donald Trump denouncing the project at a White House conference on American history in September 2020.
Critical race theory, the 1619 Project, and the crusade against American history is toxic propaganda, ideological poison that, if not removed, will dissolve the civic bonds that tie us together, will destroy our country.
Professor Stanley, your response.
This is an erasure of Black history. This is an erasure of Black perspectives. What we need to improve our democracy is we need knowledge of who has been denied equality and why. We need to know democracy is a system where we all play a role in the formation of the policies that govern us, the laws that govern us. Without Black perspectives, without the Black perspective on history, we don't know, we don't understand their voices. The grounds for eliminating and responding to stereotypes and prejudice have been robbed from us. Without critical race theory, the study of structures that maintain racial hierarchy, the study of, say, mortgage redlining, children won't understand why there are poor Black neighborhoods and wealthy white neighborhoods in their cities protected by military police. Black children will be led to believe the stereotypes about themselves and, ironically, feel shame about their own identity. These divisive concept laws that are being passed all over the country that invite students at public universities and students at public schools to report on their own teachers and professors. These are purportedly justified as students. We shouldn't have teaching that makes students feel shame about their race. Well, when you don't allow professors and teachers to teach Black history, you're making Black students feel ashamed about their race. When you don't allow LGBT perspectives, when you declare them as obscene and pornographic, you make LGBT families feel ashamed about their identity. People say, okay, it's not really banning because you can look at the web. But what's taught in schools, the perspectives that are taught in schools, affect us through our whole lives. They represent an authority, a state authority. And we're being told by MAGA Republicans that that perspective is the perspective of Christian white men.
I want to ask you to stay with us. We're going to do a post-show interview, part two, and we'll put it online at democracynow.org. Jason Stanley, author and professor of philosophy at Yale University, his new book titled Erasing History, How Fascists Rewrite the Past to Control the Future. He's also author of How Fascism Works, The Politics of Us and Them. He's the son of Holocaust survivors. Coming up, Borderland, The Line Within, a new film about the profitable business of criminalizing immigration and its human costs. Back in 20 seconds. By Sarah Kuruchich, Kachikel, songwriter from Guatemala. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We end today's show looking at immigration, a key issue in the presidential election. On the campaign trail, Democratic candidate Kamala Harris and Republican Donald Trump have competed to propose tougher policies for asylum seekers at the U.S.-Mexico border. Trump's promised to expand the draconian policies of his first term. Harris is vowing to hire thousands of additional border agents and intensify the militarization of the U.S.-Mexico border if she's elected president. Immigrant justice advocates have criticized Harris's rightward shift on immigration and the border, policies that activists say only lead to a more inhumane treatment of immigrants, increasing migrant deaths and detentions, and the separation of families. At a campaign rally in California over the weekend, Trump again threatened the mass deportation of over 10 million immigrants if he's reelected, starting in Aurora, Colorado, and Springfield, Ohio. where the Haitian community of tens of thousands is facing a wave of violent threats after Trump and his running mate J.D. Vance falsely accused Haitian immigrants of eating people's pets. Ohio Republican Governor Mike DeWine announced he's deploying state troopers and conducting daily bomb sweeps in Springfield schools after a spate of bomb threats over Trump and Vance's racist and unfounded comments, which they've both persistently defended, despite the threats to the community. Amidst this dehumanization of immigrants, a new film aims to give them a face as they speak to their in their own words about the war on immigrants in the United States, not just at the southern border, but across the country and the profitable business of criminalizing immigration. This is the trailer for Borderland, The Line Within, the new documentary by director Pamela Yates.
ICE is everywhere. The border is everywhere. For us, for immigrants.
Everyone in that team knew what the border was inside of them.
A team of digital humanists is uncovering dark details of the border industrial complex.
What if we knew the infrastructure that Hitler was building before World War II? What would we do with that knowledge?
So that you go from your house to your Dunkin' Donuts and you pass a detention facility and you don't even know that it exists.
The infrastructure that was being prepared.
That was the end game.
Getting prepared for massive separations, massive deportations.
Right. I mean, that was the end game. We kept saying that's the end game.
What does the removal of 12 million look like?
In the shadow of the border industrial complex, immigrants are building power.
I want to believe that the judge is going to allow me to stay here in the country, but if he doesn't allow me, he has to know that I'm going to fight. I'm going to fight hard.
The system is geared towards, like the old cowboy movie, give him a trial, and then we hang him.
Put the camera down.
Give him due process, and then we deport him.
Accept the militarization of the border as we are doing it, then nothing is going to stop any other crazy agenda in the future to militarize Chicago, Los Angeles, New York.
You will always, in their eyes, be the enemy.
They make us feel like we're worthless in this country.
We are the voice of those children who are crying themselves to sleep, asking for their mom or dad. ICE shouldn't be scaring us, intimidating us.
The people at the Capitol don't need to be sitting here because they have all the resources, because they have all the money.
Nothing bothers power more than you looking at their dollar signs.
It wasn't just a story about Trump and a few Republicans. All of the U.S. political scene were engaged in this activity.
We have to look at what's happening right now in the United States. In this particular historical moment, the imminent danger is the rise of fascism. It threatens all of us. It threatens the promise of the United States. For all its flaws, it still promises something. And it's something that we have to keep on fighting for.
The trailer for Borderland, The Line Within, 5 years in the making. It continues the work of director Pamela Yates over the past four decades and her past films, When the Mountains Tremble, Granito, How to Nail a Dictator, and, well, 500 years. For more, Pamela Yates joins us from the capital of New York State, from Albany, and in El Paso, Texas, we're joined by Gabriela Castañeda, an advocate with MILPA, that's the Movement of Immigrants Leaders in Pennsylvania. She's featured in the film Borderland, The Line Within. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! I was with you both last Friday night at DCTV's Firehouse Cinema when the film premiered. It is an epic work. It is a masterpiece, Pamela, especially coming out at this time of the election, when immigration is one of the top issues in this country in the election. And immigrants are being so dehumanized, from saying Haitian, the Trump and Vance saying Haitians eat pets, and to threatening mass deportation of immigrants starting in Aurora, Colorado, and in Springfield, Ohio, where so many tens of thousands of Haitians live, invited there. Pamela, talk about your film.
Sure. Borderland, The Line Within. And thank you for having us on the show today, Amy. And hello, and hello to all the Democracy Nowistas out there. The film really is the story. You know, immigration is always consequential, but it is particularly consequential at this moment in time. And the film is really about people arriving in this country who are leaders, who become leaders, who are teaching other immigrants how to become leaders, who are building strength in immigrant communities. They're not victims. They have agency, and they are teaching each other their constitutional rights as people living in the United States. But on top of that, we've built a whole other story, which is the story of the digital humanists. These are humanities scholars who are using data to uncover what's come to be known as the border industrial complex, the billions of dollars of our tax money that is being spent to capture, incarcerate, and deport immigrants into this country. We filmed the digital humanists in a kind of a liminal space, a space between the light and the dark, as they use the Freedom of Information Act and scrape the web for data to bring us what's actually going on with this money, these billions of dollars that are being spent on the back of the suffering of immigrants in our country. It's really the thing that I believe that we can contribute to the immigration debate, that we can contribute to the national conversation about immigration, that each person in the United States should know where their tax dollars are going.
This is absolutely key, because that imaging of ICE facilities across the country with the comment, the border is everywhere, is astounding. How many ICE facilities are there, Pamela?
There are hundreds, and they're all over the country. And you may not, you may be living next to one, and you may not know it. They also use county jails, but they have a lot of private detention facilities, private companies that are making millions of dollars a year on incarcerating immigrants who have not committed any crimes. It's a civil offense, and they're being held there, and it's shocking. And hundreds of dollars on each person each night is being spent to keep them locked up.
I want to turn right now to another clip of your film, Borderland, The Line Within. Our guest in El Paso, Texas, is Gabriela Castaneda. She's featured in Borderland. Let's go to that clip.
So I'm currently in the middle of an immigration process. I'm fighting for cancellation of removal. The judge is basing his accusations on a report prepared by ICE, stating that my house was used to stash undocumented immigrants, and that I was transporting these undocumented immigrants within the country. This report was prepared several years ago, exactly right after we held protests outside the detention center. And they didn't like it. Whether they like it or not, they can't deport me for that, and they know that. But they can put together a report that's going to make me look bad and say, you know what, we're not deporting you for that. You're more than welcome to protest and do whatever you want. That's your First Amendment right. But you know what? We can deport you for these things. ICE, you know, is against everything we're doing, because obviously we're challenging the status quo. They want to keep everything, you know, like it is right now. Them having the power, them abusing families, them destroying families, and nobody saying anything. Well, that's not the case. I said something, and that's why I'm being targeted. Truth. I want the truth. I want to believe that the judge is going to be able to see that then and allow me to stay here in the country. But if he doesn't allow me, he has to know that I'm going to fight.
going to fight hard.
So that's Gabriela Castaneda. She's currently with the movement of immigrant leaders in Pennsylvania, known as MILPA. She was with the Border Network for Human Rights. She's featured in Borderland, The Line Within. Gabriela joins us now from El Paso, Texas. Your husband was deported. You have three U.S.-born children, Gabriela. And the fact that you're with MILPA, Movement of Immigrant Leaders in Pennsylvania, Pennsylvania, a swing state, your thoughts about the environment and the rhetoric right now, as President Trump says if he's reelected, he will begin mass deportations.
Hi, Amy. Thanks for having us. It's a pleasure for me to be here. Exactly. Yes. What we are hearing not only from President Trump that he's going to deport us and he's been preparing this massive deportation apparatus, we're also hearing it from Kamala Harris in the terms that she is also not speaking in regards to immigration as something really good. She's trying to say to the world that I can be as tough as any other Republican. And that is problematic because we have both parties failing the people here in the United States. And what's happening right now is that the immigrants are used as scapegoats. We are blamed for all the problems in the United States. We are bombarded daily with the false and immoral idea that if there are no jobs or decent wages or access to free medical care or decent housing, it's because of immigrants. We went from being rapists and criminals to now eating pets in Springfield, which is obviously not true. The truth is that the needs of immigrants are no different from the needs of the rest of the population. This film asks the people to internalize this thought. Who wins with family separations and deportations? It's not the average American citizen. And while we continue to fight amongst ourselves, the poor people, other sectors, the structural problems in our nation continue to be not resolved. The border industrial complex has been trying to push down our throats this narrative that you must be afraid of immigrants, that they're coming to take away your jobs, that we're having an invasion, that we're having open borders, because it's very rentable for them. If they are able to instill fear in the population, then it's easier for them to sell their goods. We have one of the most militarized borders in the world, even when we are not at war with our neighboring country. We have Black Hawk helicopters that are used for wars. We have cameras, sensors, walls, more boots on the ground. And we just learned that the 2024 budget to protect the border is $25 billion. This is not an attack only on immigrants. This is an attack on every poor people living in this country, because while they're using this money to protect us from who they think it's the enemy, which is the immigrant, that money is not being used to improve our schools or infrastructure, public transportation. And so we need to understand that the problem of the immigrant is the problem of the white poor people and the black poor people, and that we need to come together to fight so that those needs become rights. But that's only going to happen when we unite.
I want to go back to Pamela Yates, the director of the film, to talk about the other person featured in this film. You have Gabriela, who we're talking to now, and Kash. And that relates to a past film you made. And it goes to the issue of asylum seekers coming into this country, fleeing often in countries, in Kasha's case, of course, Guatemala, where the U.S. supported right-wing death squads who killed so many of the population, perhaps hundreds of thousands, and what the aftermath of that caused, Pamela.
Yes, well, it opened up the country to extractive mining, to international companies coming in to take minerals out of the ground. And Kash Mural, the other protagonist in Borderland, The Line Within, is an environmental defender. He's defending the Mayan ancestral lands in his village in the Ixchel region of northern Guatemala. While he's doing that, and as he's becoming a leader, he's receiving death threats. and gradually people around him are beginning to be killed. So he feels he must flee, and he flees trying to seek asylum in the United States. And as he's fleeing, he contacts me because we knew each other from a past film, and he says, don't come. It's way too dangerous. He said, I've already left. So my role from then on was to work with him to document his story as he came, and also to try to find out ways to keep him safe.
And how long was that journey, Pamela? How long was that journey? We just have 30 seconds.
2 months. It was 2 months, the journey, and he was languishing for several years in Ciudad Juarez, trying to get into the United States.
And what happens when he gets here is incredible. Pamela, in these last 20 seconds, what you're trying to do with this film is it opens all over the country.
We're now on the Abrazos Tour, which is a 26 cities. We're opening in 26 cities, north, south, east, and west in the United States. We hope everyone will join us. We hope everyone will become informed. We hope everyone will vote. And we hope everyone.